From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. American disaster relief expert Fred Cuny disappeared in Chechnya last April. Yesterday, his family announced they were giving up their search after hearing from several sources that he was executed by Chechen rebels. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature a 1993 interview with Fred Cuny, in which he described what it was like to rebuild gas and water lines in Bosnia while under fire. Also today, in the spirit of summer reading, we feature an interview with novelist Russell Banks. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new thriller, The Usual Suspects. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The United States and Kuwait have decided to hold a scheduled military exercise in Kuwait in about 10 days' time instead of in the autumn as part of U.S. precautions against possible Iraqi military action. Baghdad today scoffed at U.S. claims that it had made provocative troop movements. Authorities in Paris are bracing themselves for a possible new wave of terrorism. A day after the second bomb attack in the city this summer injured 17 people, police are searching for clues as to who did it, and Parisians are on alert. Joe Schumann reports from Paris.
A banner headline on an evening newspaper Friday said it all. Paris is afraid. Recordings in the metro warn riders to report suspicious packages or bags. Shoppers entering public buildings have their purses searched first. Police patrols are everywhere, and people begin conversations asking, has there been another explosion? Police said the bomb that sprayed nails through a crowd of tourists near the Arc de Triomphe Thursday is the same kind that injured 84 people and killed 7 on the metro 3 weeks ago. Authorities suspect the bombs are the work of Islamic extremists from Algeria. And a witness to yesterday's attack has helped investigators sketch the face of one of two men who fled the scene and looked North African. Paris Mayor Jean Tivoli said on the radio that Parisians should be alert and not fall into the trap of fear. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Schumann in Paris.
Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic entered a second round of talks today with U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Richard Holbrooke. As diplomatic efforts move forward, Croatia continued to mass troops in Dubrovnik in preparation for an assault on Serb forces in the surrounding foothills. UN officials say they want to investigate possible executions by Croatian soldiers following the Croatian army's recapture of the rebel Serb Krajina region. Representatives of more than 20 nations in the Caribbean are meeting in Trinidad and Tobago today with the aim of forming the world's fourth-largest trading bloc. Cuba's participation in the summit prompted a boycott by U.S. dependencies, NPR's David Wellner reports.
Despite the U.S. boycott of this first meeting of the Association of Caribbean States, Cuban President Fidel Castro was the most warmly applauded of the 18 heads of state attending the summit after an uncharacteristically short 7-minute speech. In it, Castro lamented what he described as the painful absence of Puerto Rico at the gathering. Washington has vetoed the participation of any of its dependencies due to the United States' 34-year trade embargo against Cuba. At the behest of Cuba, the leaders gathered in Port of Spain are signing a document today rejecting policies that restrict the development of member nations, a clear reference to the U.S. embargo against Cuba. Those nations hope to form a free trade zone for the Caribbean region's 200 million inhabitants by the turn of the century. I'm David Wellner reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 13 points at 4617.6. This is NPR News. A ruling by a superior court judge in California today is expected to mean that Judge Lance Ito will not have to excuse himself from the O.J. Simpson murder trial. Judge John Reed said today Ito's wife can offer no relevant testimony in the Simpson murder trial. Reed listened to 12 hours of tape recordings of Detective Mark Furman before rejecting prosecutors' claims that L.A. Police Captain Margaret York should testify. NATO is beginning peacekeeping exercise in Louisiana. Soldiers from 14 former East Bloc nations are taking part. John Greenberg reports from Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Another Black Hawk helicopter lands and about 15 Albanian infantrymen jump to the ground. Using whistles and hand signals, they form up by the tree line and head off to man checkpoints and observation posts. It's all part of the international peacekeeping exercise called Cooperative Nugget. soldiers from 14 former Warsaw Pact countries are training alongside NATO troops. The goal is to fold these countries into the NATO military structure. John Greenberg, Fort Polk, Louisiana.
A raid at a meatpacking plant in Norfolk, Nebraska could result in about 100 arrests. Immigration agents and police raided the Beef America plant, the nation's fifth largest meat packer. A similar raid in March at a plant owned by XL Corporation ended with about 125 deportations. Bad weather has delayed the rescue of Western climbers on the world's second highest mountain, K2, in northern Pakistan. At least two members of a Spanish expedition are reported to have frostbite and need immediate medical treatment. Officials have decided not to retrieve the bodies of at least five other mountaineers who died earlier this week near the summit of K2. Among the dead are famed Scottish climber Alison Hargreaves. The climb's organizer, Nazir Sabir, said the area where the climbers died is too treacherous to risk bringing in help. I'm Frank Stasio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist Russell Banks. The Dictionary of Literary Biography describes his novels as trailer park fiction, books about working-class people living their lives one step up from the lowest rung on the socioeconomic ladder and doing battle every day with the despair that comes from violence, alcohol, and self-destructive relationships. Banks is the author of Continental Drift, Affliction, and The Sweet Hereafter. His latest novel, Rule of the Bone, is about a 14-year-old nicknamed Bone, who has all the signs of increasing alienation. He wears a mohawk, has his nose and ears pierced, is doing lousy in school, hangs out at the mall, and spends all his money on marijuana. The book opens with him stealing from his mother and stepfather so he can buy more marijuana. His parents throw him out of the house. After taking up with bikers and drug dealers, Bone crosses the line and turns into a real criminal. I spoke with Russell Banks when the novel was published in May. It's written in the voice of the boy. Here's Russell Banks reading from the opening of the novel.
Anyhow, my life got interesting, you might say. The summer I turned 14 and was heavy into weed, but I didn't have any money to buy it with, so I started looking around the house all the time for things I could sell, but there wasn't much. My mother, who was still like my best friend then, and my stepfather Ken had this decent house that my mother'd gotten a divorce from my real father about 10 years ago, and about that she just says she got a mortgage, not a house, and about him she doesn't say much at all, although my grandmother does. My mom and Ken both had these cheesy jobs and didn't own anything you could rob, at least not without them noticing right away it was gone. Ken worked as a maintenance man out at the airbase, which is like being a janitor, only he said he was a building services technician. And my mom was a bookkeeper at the clinic, which is also a nothing job, looking at a computer screen all day and punching numbers into it. It actually started with me roaming around the house after school looking for something that wasn't boring, porn books or videos maybe, or condoms, anything. Plus, who knows, they might have their own little stash of weed. My mom and especially Ken were seriously into alcohol then, but maybe they weren't as uptight as they seem, I'm thinking. Anything is possible. The house was small, four rooms and a bathroom, a mobile home on cinder blocks like a regular house, only without a basement or garage and no attic. And I'd lived there with my mom and my real dad from the time I was three until he left, which happened when I was five. And after that, with my mom and Ken, who legally adopted me and became my stepfather up until now. So I knew the place like I knew the inside of my mouth.
Russell Banks, thanks for reading that. Tell me how you decided to open the book with the son trying to rob his parents so he could get money to buy some marijuana.
Well, I think I was looking for an occasion that would let a kid, this kid, sort of drop out, drop through the safety net, the last and maybe the only safety net he had and most kids have, which is basically the family. And I had talked to a lot of kids older than this one, you know, in their teens and early 20s, and asked them and just over the matter of time had learned that they had been living on their own, ended up living on their own, oftentimes for a very trivial offense, the kind of thing that almost anybody is capable of doing when you're 14 or 15, robbing a car, robbing somebody, getting into dope or something like that. And it just seemed like the kind of event that would naturally occur to a kid, but might have disastrous consequences. And stealing his mother's coin collection in order to buy weed with was that kind of event. I mean, it's sort of like that's the final straw, you know, that I was looking for. And it's only a straw, but it's the final one. And then he's out, and he's on his own.
How did you know the kids who you talked to about this?
Well, they're all around us, I guess, so just generally. But in particular, I teach college kids, and I have raised four kids myself. And also, I was a couple of years ago doing a creative writing workshop with a friend at a prison in upstate New York, and was dealing mostly with 18 to 22-year-old guys who were mostly drug dealers and had all been living on their own, more or less, since they were, you know, in their early teens. And so one of the things we had them writing about was how they came to live on their own. When did you fall out of the nest? And they all told stories more or less like that. Well, you know, I stole a car or something, or I got into a fight, or, you know, they had dropped out of school, and the pieces of their life, they were falling apart. Their lives are so fragile, and the support systems that surround them are so basically ineffective in dealing with a little crisis that, you know, by the time they were 15 or 16, they were on their own and on the streets.
Were there places in writing Rule of the Bone where you felt you least understood what this character would do or say?
That's a good question. But I have to be honest with you. I don't think so. I think once I was listening to him and sufficiently immersed in his world, I pretty much felt confident that I knew what he would do in a given situation. I didn't always know what the situation was going to be, certainly. But no, I don't think that I had to puzzle it out too deeply or too carefully. It just seemed to come to me very quickly and automatically.
You have some things in common with the character in your book. Your father was abusive. You were a rebellious teenager. But you were rebellious, 30-some-odd years ago. Were there mysteries that this character had for you that were partly maybe because of the times, because he's rebelling in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and there are some things from what he might get tattooed to what he might be listening to, mm-hmm. to how he's going to act out his rebellious feelings, you know, that would be different from yours.
Oh, yeah, sure. The main thing, I think probably the most obvious thing, is drugs. When I was 16, I stole a car and ran across the country and disappeared for 3 months and, you know, did some of the destructive and angry things that the Bone does and that a lot of kids do. But there wasn't the danger. I couldn't step into the world of drugs that easily and that quickly. I would have had to have really worked hard to do that. And this was, you know, in the late 50s. And Bone doesn't have to work hard. It's in the air he breathes. I mean, it's easier for kids to buy illegal substances than it is for them to buy alcohol when you're under 16. Much easier, and it's just in the world for them. So that's a huge difference. The whole drug culture is a huge difference, and the drug economy. When I was a kid, it was a tiny sub economy. I mean, it didn't really exist as such, but today it's a major part of the economy. So that's a huge factor, a difference. The other difference, I know, looking at Bone and when I got into him, was the issue of race. America was much more segregated when I was growing up, and you could grow up a white kid and into adolescence and drop out and move about the country and so forth. And if you were a white kid, you would never really be forced to deal with the issue of race. It was still a kind of invisible topic for you, unless you happen to end up in unusual circumstances. Whereas for Bone, it's you know, it's there instantly.
Did you steal from your parents?
Sure. Did you?
Actually, no. And I'm not just saying that because they might be listening. No, I really didn't. So what did you take?
Oh, small things, you know, things I wanted for myself. The worst thing I think I did was I stole, well, should I be saying this on national radio? I stole my grandfather's watch and claimed that it was my own and was eventually caught. But it was a kind of a symbolic act, I think, because my grandfather was a watchmaker. And I guess maybe I was trying to steal his identity in some way.
Did you try to pawn it? Or did you just want the act of
claiming
it as your own?
I just wanted the act. I wanted to wear it, and I wanted it on my arm. But I stole a car. I stole. I didn't steal with any compulsion, I don't think. I shoplifted. I think a lot of kids do that. Try it out. It's testing the limits, testing the edges, I think, trying to define the cause and effect of our relations between yourself and the larger world.
Some of the characters in this book are substitute father figures for Bone, for the teenager. One guy is big in the Hell's Angels. Another guy is small in kiddie porn. There's a Rastafarian who basically becomes his mentor. Mm-hmm. Do you think a kid with an abusive father is basically an easy target in a way for false father figures?
Oh, sure. I think that... a kid, yeah, with an abusive father, without a father, or with a father who himself feels inadequate, or unsure of how he's supposed to protect and teach a son or a child of either gender, is bound to go searching for a substitute.
Did you?
Oh, sure, I did. Yeah, I mean, you start moving out from your own immediate family almost immediately as soon as that person in your immediate family fails you, you're going to go looking for it.
Did you find any father figures that led you in the wrong direction?
Oh, sure. And a few that led me in the right direction, too.
I imagine some of the ones that led you in the right direction were writing teachers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What about the guys who led you in the wrong direction?
Well, yeah, there were a couple. there was a guy who was an ex-con. It was a had been a barker at strip shows in Atlantic City that I ended up traveling with. And, when I was a young guy, I'd attach myself to older guys who seemed smarter than I and more at ease in the world than I. And then sometimes, you know, you're lucky. But I don't think I was lucky until I was in my 20s, and then I began to locate men who could, who could see in me what was probably worth saving and nurture that and could... give me a sense of self-worth that allowed me to step around and eventually avoid the kinds of behavior that would have put me in jail in upstate New York by the time I was 25.
What do you think the barker from the strip show saw in you?
Well, one of the things he saw in me is I had a driver's license at the time, and he didn't have one. And I could get a car in Miami and drive it across the country. And so he was actually a gambler more than he was a barker. He was out of jail, and he was gambling, and I ran into him down in Key West when I was a kid. And I was just, I think, around 19. And he took me under his wing, as it were, but he also used me. I think that's the kind of bad father you get, the one who's using you for something for himself.
Russell Banks is my guest. His new novel is called Rule of the Bone. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Russell Banks, his new novel is called Rule of the Bone. Your father, who was abusive, left your family when you were 12. So while he was part of the family, he was always bigger than you, probably a lot bigger than you. You were a kid. Mm-hmm. Did you ever confront him as a man?
Oh, yeah. We made our peace, actually. I went back and dealt with my father very closely. I even worked alongside him. He was a plumber, and I became a plumber. And worked with him, and even lived in his house for a period too when I was in my 20s, and became never really affectionate, but close, if that's possible. It certainly was how I experienced it. We were close. I was very involved with him right up to the end of his life. He died in 1979 at 63, when I was in my 30s, and. So, yeah, we dealt. I never, I think, had that kind of vengeful clarification with him, but I didn't really need it or want it by the time I was in my 20s.
There's something that I think I might have asked you about once before, but it still really interests me. You once said that your father felt that, you know, moving up in life was a betrayal, that mm-hmm. it was somehow a rebuke of the life that he had led.
Yeah.
And unless you were just doing some wheeler-dealer thing and finagling something, yeah. in which case that was fine. What do you think is the difference between the impulse to you know, sacrifice for the children so the children can have more than you do, and the impulse to feel, well, why should they have more than me? What's good enough for me is going to be good mm-hmm. enough for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a difference in believing in the American dream and no longer believing in the American dream. That if one generation sacrifices itself for the next generation, that next generation will profit from it and move up in society and be empowered in such a way as to make it even better for the third generation. It's that three-generation syndrome. And many Americans have not, after having been here for a long time, African Americans and white Americans too, who have gone through 8, 10, 15 generations in America, don't find that model, that dream doesn't describe their experience. And I think they grow bitter and mistrustful, profoundly mistrustful of anybody who separates themselves from them. By moving up, you know, and so forth. It isn't that they just accept their fate, it's that they feel there is no realistic alternative. And if you're advancing yourself in society, you're rejecting them. It's a way of disconnecting yourself from them.
So tell me more about why you think your father felt that, you know, if one of his kids moved up, it was somehow a betrayal.
Well, it probably, since he didn't feel he was sacrificing in his youth. My father's a very bright man, very gifted man in many ways. He was a child of the Depression and went to work when he was 16 and dropped out of school and worked with his hands his entire life. And he was bitter about that, I think, and didn't feel as though that was he was sacrificing anything. So he was in some ways not connected to his own children, the next generation, to their future. And so by having that sense of disconnectedness, if I didn't live his life exactly, more or less the same, I challenged and humiliated him for that. It wasn't as though, you know, by my living a different kind of life, I validated and justified a sacrifice on his part.
Do you think that held you back for a long time?
I think it injured my sense of self-esteem and made me feel for a long time essentially inadequate and incapable of achieving. I wasn't raised to believe that, really, that anything was possible for me and that my parents were sacrificing in order to advance me in the world. So, yeah, I think that there was a bit of a disability there. But on the other hand, it made me, in a way, more the master of my own fate, too. I didn't owe anything to anybody backwards in time, you know. Whatever I got, one way or the other, I got it myself.
Was there a teacher who helped kind of counteract that sense of advancement as betrayal?
Yeah, early on, in my early 20s, I had the great good fortune to run into the novelist Nelson Algren, when he was in his late 40s and I was in my early 20s, and it was purely, you know, fortuitous. And he read some of the stories that I was then writing, and I was working as a pipe fitter actually in Concord, New Hampshire at the time, and had gone up to Breadloaf Writers' Conference because I admired his work and I saw his name on an advertisement, and had taken a week off work and drove up to Vermont to be a participant in this conference, and he. This is another case of a guy who was glad I had a driver's license to befriend me because Algren, like a lot of American novelists of the open road, didn't have a driver's license, like Jack Kerouac, and needed me to drive him around, so which I happily did. But he was a little larger than that and had a greater sense of his own responsibility and power than that, and became a kind of a mentor and model in some ways for me, very important ways when I was a young writer. that lasted, and they last even to today. I mean, I'll still sometimes find myself saying, well, I wonder what Nelson would do now. What would he say here? How would he handle this situation?
Did he help you figure out that you could use the stuff of your life as the subject of fiction?
Yeah, absolutely, that you could bear witness, and that bearing witness was important and at the center of American literature, really, and going back to Whitman.
I want to get back to the teaching in prison that you did, which helped inspire Rule of the Bone, your new novel. You obviously got a lot out of teaching there.
Well, it's very brief, and you know, not an extensive experience, but I was able to extrapolate, you know, from it pretty quickly.
What did you want to give? I mean, did you think, well, I'll help these guys become professional writers?
Oh,
I
no,
mean, yeah, right.
No,
so,
no.
So what was it that you thought helping them to write would give them?
Well, I think perhaps just maybe give them an ability, which they already had the ability, but just help to tap and shape that ability to tell their own story. We all need to construct a narrative for our lives in order to make them meaningful, in order to make moral sense out of them. Otherwise, it's just a kind of kaleidoscope of images and memories, and that's essentially meaningless. And so it's just give them an opportunity to tell their story, to help organize the material and put it in sequence and give it some structure and give them the understanding that their language was sufficiently powerful to construct a believable narrative of their lives. And they were in a context with each other where they could challenge each other interestingly and usefully. They could say, oh, come on, man, it doesn't work that way. Or, you know, come on, man, you deserved that. What are you saying? This is just special pleading. You know, they could could check it against their own realities, each other's realities, and not get away with anything. So that was very helpful for them.
You've hit on something that really interests me, the idea that you need to construct a narrative to find meaning in your life. Otherwise, it's just this wash of
experience. Otherwise, we have to inherit the one that's given to us, you know, which is often a demoralizing and humiliating narrative. Say, oh, well, you're just that kind of kid, or you're just that kind of man or woman who, you know, we hear those stereotypical narratives all the time. And they're almost always humiliating and demeaning. But the real authentic existential narrative of our own life is what gives it its moral significance and reality.
Well, I really believe that, too. And, I mean, that's what I love about a lot of great fiction and nonfiction. And, you know, in a really teeny tiny way, that's what you try to offer on an interview show, is a chance for those narratives to be told. Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, I have this terrible feeling that in America, everybody is being encouraged now to build these fake narratives.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? To just go on afternoon talk shows and accuse your mother of having, you know, hurt you in some great or small way, or to market your story in some kind of public relations type of way to sell yourself or to sell a product. And I feel like everybody's walking around now with the kind of false and true narrative construction of their lives.
All right, I agree. I mean, and so many of them are well, what makes them false is that they're basically simplistic. You explain your life in these really reductive, simplistic, causal ways, rather than admitting into them the complexity of motives and circumstances that actually do create your life.
Russell Banks, his latest novel, Rule of the Bone, was published in May, which is when our interview was recorded. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
American disaster relief expert Fred Cuny disappeared in Chechnya last April. His family led a search for him, but yesterday they announced they ended the search after receiving information from several sources that Cuny was executed by Chechen rebels. Coming up, a 1993 interview with Fred Cuny. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new thriller, The Usual Suspects.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Pentagon officials said today the U.S. and Kuwait have decided to move up scheduled military exercises. The maneuvers will be held in about 10 days instead of autumn. Earlier today, U.S. and Jordanian forces began maneuvers west of Iraq. Meanwhile, Iraq has denied any unusual military activity following U.S. reports suggesting possible Iraqi attack on Jordan or Kuwait. Microsoft has reportedly acquired a Rolling Stones song to use in its advertisements for Windows 95. It's the first time the songwriters have authorized the commercial use of one of their tunes. From member station KUOW in Seattle, Bill Radke reports.
The London tabloid The Sun reports that Microsoft is paying the Stones $12 million for rights to the song Start Me Up. Microsoft chair Bill Gates apparently thought the song would be perfect for advertising the company's new operating system because a key new feature is an on-screen start button to launch programs. It's reportedly the first time Mick Jagger and Keith Richards have agreed to the commercial use of one of their songs, although other Stones songs not controlled by Jagger and Richards have been used commercially. Windows 95 is Microsoft's first new operating system since 1990. It's scheduled to hit the stores next Thursday, and many analysts believe it will be the best-selling program in the world. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Radke in Seattle.
Hurricane Felix is staying out in the Atlantic, but forecasters warn the storm could threaten the mid-Atlantic coast again. Residents and tourists evacuated a lot of the beach areas. Jim Ricketts, a spokesman for the Convention Bureau in Virginia Beach, said this morning that businesses have lost a lot of money because of Felix.
Our occupancy was down to about 30%. We estimate we were losing about $2.1 million a day. And if Felix doesn't come back, it looks like our total economic loss would be around $10 million in sales.
Resort owners are hoping tourists will return. Hostage negotiators from Scotland Yard have arrived in India to help win the release of four Western tourists. One American is among those being held by Kashmiri separatists. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from Kashmir.
The Scotland Yard officials, along with German and American negotiators, were dispatched here to help convince the rebel group Al-Furan to release the four tourists. Indian officials say they have not ruled out staging a rescue attempt, but consider it a last resort. Krishnan Rao, governor of Kashmir, says the mountainous terrain would make a surprise attack difficult.
By the time the forces get there, they can take a decision to eliminate these people. That danger is always there.
The rebel group has already killed one hostage, Norwegian tourist Hans Astro, and has threatened to kill the remaining four unless India agrees to release 15 Kashmiri militants from prison. But Indian officials have refused to meet that demand, insisting that the four hostages be released immediately and unconditionally. This is Eric Weiner in Srinagar, India.
This is NPR News. Shannon Faulkner still hasn't returned to training. The Citadel's first female cadet fell ill Monday after marching in extreme heat. A spokesman for the South Carolina Military School says he can't confirm or deny rumors that Faulkner might go home. Faulkner fell ill on Monday after marching in extreme heat. An anti-abortion activist from Wisconsin is being held by federal authorities to face charges that he stole $250,000 to finance a war against abortion. Annalise Hensel of member station WUWM reports.
33-year-old Robert Cook of Caledonia, Wisconsin, is accused of stealing the money from a bank security van last September. Since then, he's alleged to have traveled around the nation buying weapons and trying to recruit others to wage violence on abortion clinics. Authorities say they've been investigating Cook for 11 months, but arrested him in Illinois on Wednesday after hearing he was plotting to kill a doctor who performs abortions soon. U.S. Attorney Thomas Schneider.
Once we had received specific information that an attempted murder may take place, we felt it was important to proceed to a complaint and arrest as soon as possible.
Cook is being held without bail in Illinois. He's set to be extradited to Milwaukee next week to face bank larceny charges. For National Public Radio, I'm Annalise Hensel in Milwaukee.
Police say a witness saw a man shoving a package into a garbage can just before a bomb blast in Paris wounded 17 people. The blast aroused fears of a wave of future attacks, coming 23 days after a similar explosive device in a metro station killed 7 people and wounded 86. No one has claimed responsibility for either bombing. On Wall Street today, stock prices closed mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 13 points to close at 4617.6. Advances led declines by 6 to 5 on volume of 312 million shares. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fred Cuny, an American relief worker, devoted his life to rebuilding villages and cities that had been destroyed by war or natural disaster. His work often put his own life at risk. That work took him to Somalia, northern Iraq, the Sudan, Nicaragua, and Biafra. In early April, he disappeared in Chechnya, where he was conducting a humanitarian relief assessment. His brother Chris and his son Craig led a search for Cuny. Yesterday, the family called off their search, saying they had information from several sources that Fred Cuny was executed by Chechen rebels in mid-April. The family says a Russian translator and 2 Russian aid workers traveling with Cuny were executed as well. Cuny's brother and son held a press conference in Moscow yesterday, where they blamed Russian intelligence operatives for spreading disinformation that led Chechens to believe that Cuny was a spy and anti-Islamic. Russian intelligence denies the charges, and the Russian government says it believes Cuny is still alive. But as far as the Cuny family is concerned, Fred Cuny is dead, even though there's no corpse to prove it. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Fred Cuny recorded in November 1993 while he was on a brief visit to the United States. At the time, he was rebuilding gas and water lines in Sarajevo. He and his team were racing to complete the project before the onset of the harsh Bosnian winter. Fred Cuny explained why this project was so important.
Without our project, people have to go down from the hills into the center part of the city in order to fetch water and firewood. And when they do that, they come into the area where the snipers are active from the other side, and many people are killed standing in line or trying to fetch the water and the firewood. In the winter, it's terribly cold. Temperatures are sub-zero from the end of October through the end of April. And especially during the periods when there's snow and ice, it's very difficult to walk several kilometers down into that area, stand in the line of fire, gather the water, take it back to the house, then have to go back out again to get firewood, bring it back in, and go back out again to get food and relief supplies. So our whole effort has been to try and turn the system around, to take energy and to take water to the people to reduce the amount of time that they're spent in the line of fire and the amount of time they have to spend collecting goods and commodities in order to survive.
But, you know, it seems like it would be almost impossible to rebuild part of the infrastructure while Sarajevo is still under siege.
Well, the things that we focused on, water and sanitation and gas, are all linear systems that are underground. Pipes are low enough in the ground that they're not subject to being destroyed by the artillery. And the gas mains are the same way. They're buried in the ground. Usually up to half a meter or more below the surface, so they're difficult to destroy. Now, what the Serbs could do is blow up the pumping stations and the pressurization stations and the regulating stations, and they have done that in some areas. So what we did is look at ways of putting the water into the system where we wouldn't require pumps. We would be able to put the water in at the high end of the city, up in the hills, and then let gravity do the distribution and not rely on energy-driven pumps to pump water up to reservoirs. So we have some pumps in our system, but they're far less than the municipal system used before the war. In the case of the gas, we've been working at ways of protecting the regulators so they can't be destroyed, and burying them in some places or putting them in revetments that would be difficult to destroy, and then working to try and keep the pressure on during the winter.
I believe most of your work has been in developing countries. Sarajevo was a thriving international city. How does that change things for you? Is this a different kind of experience than you've ever had before?
It's very different. The biggest thing is, of course, is the high standard of expectation people have on their living standards and in terms of the food that they eat. In the third world, people often have very restricted diets, usually one grain, some oil, maybe some beans or some other source of protein, occasionally meat. The people of Sarajevo are used to a very rich diet, a varied diet, a full mix of meats and fish and vegetables and so on. And for them, to be put back on a relief diet is something that is just utterly shocking to them. That said, I think they've adapted quite well and are taking it in stride and have made adaptations and certainly with the seeds have been able to grow more of the things that they particularly like to eat. For us, though, the biggest problem is that we're working in a winter environment, and the international community has not really been prepared for operations in European or in cold weather environments. We work in the tropics, and all the doctrines, all the programs, the various tools and materials and strategies that we use are all designed for tropical areas where we have tropical diseases, tropical parasites. You have foods that are acclimated to the tropical needs. We don't have to deal with heavy clothing and blankets and so forth. The operations in cold weather are extremely expensive. You're not talking about just providing blankets and sheets. You're talking about providing sleeping bags if there's no energy. Energy becomes a big issue here, not just firewood for fuel, but heating 24 hours a day, and especially different groups of vulnerables. In the third world, the only group that you're really worried about, or the main groups you're worried about, are children under five and pregnant and lactating women. That's where the majority of deaths occur. In cold weather operations, you get not only those groups, but also elderly are at risk because they often are not able to go out and get the energy they need for fire, you know, to heat their houses and for cooking. Clothing is much more expensive. Clothing is rarely a major issue in the third world, yet winter clothing becomes an issue in these cold weather operations. And the costs are astronomical. Normally we can get by with a couple dollars a day per refugee or per disaster victim in the third world. It's running us well over $10 and sometimes $20 a day to supply people in the cold weather environments. So these operations are extremely expensive and very difficult to deal with.
We're featuring a 1993 interview with American relief expert Fred Cuny, who disappeared in Chechnya last April. Yesterday, his family said they have information confirming he was executed. We'll hear more from our interview in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1993 interview with Fred Cuny. Your company, Intertect, is not a charitable organization. It's a for-profit company. I'm not sure how much a profit you actually make with the work that you do. But you've in fact criticized some charitable organizations for being, and I quote, the last great reserve of the professional amateur. That's a comment you made a few years ago. Do you still stand by that?
Well, I think this is a problem in humanitarianism across the board, is that there are very few professional organizations. I didn't say that that everyone is unprofessional, but we have in the case of Bosnia, for example, we've seen some major mistakes in terms of the approach to this war, attempts to try and apply African operational doctrines and programs to a European setting.
For example?
Probably the best example are the attempts to use the supplemental feeding programs in the country. Supplementary feeding is a strategy that's used to rehabilitate people who are coming out of a famine, to bring them back up to a standard of nutrition to where they can go into normal feeding programs. There's no need for this in Bosnia. We shouldn't be putting money into it. What we need to do is to improve the general ration if we have people who are losing weight and beginning to deteriorate. Very few children have been affected by starvation in Bosnia. Adults have been giving their food to the children, whereas in Africa it's usually the opposite. The survival strategies of the developing countries mean that you abandon the weakest children, whereas in Europe the strategy is that you protect your children, they're your cultural heritage and so forth. So we're applying a very expensive and resource intensive effort to a problem that doesn't exist.
Do you feel like you're learning what kind of food programs, what kind of aid programs would be most efficient in a European city like Sarajevo?
Well, there are a lot of lessons that we're learning. Food is probably not the biggest one. That didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that you need fattier foods in colder weather. We knew that. But we're learning a lot about the cities under siege and how they operate and what's needed in those situations. For example, as we approach the winter, there's been a big debate within the relief organizations about how to make the houses warmer. What is the strategy we should be using? The UN last year slapped together a strategy that basically provided an opaque plastic sheet which could be taped over the windows, and that's designed to break the wind and to keep the cold out. But it has no thermal value, no insulating value. And we've argued that there are much better materials that are available on the market, foils and a combination of bubble plastic and foil, that will provide a tremendous amount of insulating value that could be more effective and could be used to insulate the houses in such a way that you'd get a reflective component of energy production that would be contributed back in and raise the temperature level, or could make the use of fuels much more efficient. And we've been lobbying very hard within the relief groups to try and get them to use those strategies. We've learned a lot about how to seal rooms up and to make them warmer, what types of stoves are more efficient than others or less efficient, as the case may be. And all of these are going into the store of knowledge. But getting back to your earlier comment about the unprofessionalism of this, some of these lessons we learned in northern Iraq over 2 years ago. And one of the things that's been very surprising is to see many of the agencies who were active in northern Iraq, where those lessons were painfully learned over that two-year period, coming and deploying staff in Bosnia who were new, who were starting at the same point that we started in northern Iraq. And all the lessons from northern Iraq did not transfer to Bosnia. The lessons from Armenia, the earthquake there in 1988, the relief operations in Russia last year, none of those lessons seem to have gotten into the system. And we started once again at square one. And when I criticize the international relief community, it's for not making those lessons available, for not getting the information back into the headquarters groups and into the training programs, and in many cases for not training staff before they go out to these areas.
Have you had any close calls while rebuilding the water or gas system that you could tell us about?
Have I had any? Yeah, every day. certainly our vehicles come under fire quite often. Snipers have taken shots at us. We've been very lucky. All our staff, international and as well as our local staff, have not had serious injuries or wounds as a result of this. But we've had a lot of close calls, and some sooner or later it's probably going to catch up to some of us.
You're not afraid to go out every day and work? Or you just do it in spite of the fact that you're afraid?
Well, you'd be a fool not to be afraid. We certainly watch the news reports and find out where, listen to the radio and find out where the firing is during the day. We know, you know, the areas where sniping occurs, and you certainly know the main areas along the lines of contact where there's a lot of firing, and you avoid those as much as you can. There are routes that go through the city. There's one road we all call the Trail of Tears, where the city has put containers and metal panels and stuff up so that people who are walking from one end of the city to the other have some cover, and our vehicles try and move very rapidly through those areas. But there is no place in the city that's 100% safe, and every day you do run risks. But this is where the people have needs, and you have to go to where the people are in order to provide the assistance. We can't. I don't feel we can back off just because of a risk. These people take the risks every day. We should have to take them as well if we're going to provide humanitarian assistance.
Fred Cuny, recorded in 1993. According to his Dallas-based company, Intertect, Cuny's water restoration project in Sarajevo is now providing about 90% of Sarajevo's available clean water. Cuny disappeared in Chechnya last April. Yesterday, his family gave up their search, saying they believe he was executed. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports on U.S. increasing troop strength in the Persian Gulf area in response to a reported buildup of Iraqi troops threatening Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Linda Wertheimer has a discussion about this week's Whitewater indictments. Ina Jaffe reports on the discovery of a garment sweatshop in Los Angeles using Thai immigrants. Andy Bowers reports from Dubrovnik, Croatia, on a buildup of Croatian troops in that region. Essayist Donald McCaig on the tough work of getting in the summer's hay. And a Finnish group plays surf music. The group is Laika and the Cosmonauts.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Brian Singer and screenwriter Christopher McQuarrie went to high school together in Princeton Junction, New Jersey. 5 years later, they got together and made a movie called Public Access, which went on to share the Grand Jury Prize at the 1993 Sundance Film Festival. That was enough to convince Gramercy Pictures that they ought to be allowed to make their next picture, a convoluted film noir. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Usual Suspects.
If there had never been a Quentin Tarantino, and in particular, if there had never been a Quentin Tarantino movie called Reservoir Dogs, The Usual Suspects might look even better than it does. Like Reservoir Dogs, it's a heist picture in which all the talk about the heist is more important than the heist itself. It's a crime movie in which what matters is not the crime, but the eerie psychological states of the criminals. Reservoir Dogs was funnier, crazier, more violent, and more stylish, but no matter. The Usual Suspects is still very, very entertaining. The movie begins with the heist itself, and it's immediately clear that something has gone terribly wrong. Just one of the gang members has survived, a crippled small-timer named Verbal Kint, who's played very ingeniously by Kevin Spacey. Verbal is immediately hauled in for questioning. He's the only one who knows what really happened. But getting that information out of him proves tricky, as the federal agent, played by Chaz Palminteri, quickly discovers.
Verbal, you know we're trying to help you.
Sure, and I appreciate that. And I want to help you, Agent Kuyan. I like cops. I would have liked to have been a fed myself, but my CP always...
Verbal, you're not telling us everything. I know you know something.
May I have a cigarette?
According to your statement...
I need a light.
According to your statement, you're a short con operator. Running the mill scams.
That's been suppressed. Anything in there is inadmissible.
Oh, I know. Sweet deal you have here. Total immunity.
Well, I do have the weapons charge. I'm looking at 6 whole months, hard time.
You know a dealer named Ruby Dima, Verbal?
You know a religious guy named John Paul?
You know Ruby's in Attica?
He didn't have my lawyer.
In the end, it's Verbal who tells the story in flashback, and it's a terrific yarn, full of unlikely twists and even less likely characters. There's the elusive Kaiser Soze, a legendary criminal who either controls the entire world or doesn't exist at all. There's Soze's elegant henchman, who speaks with a Pakistani accent, has a Japanese name, and is played by the British actor Pete Postlethwaite. And then there are the gang members themselves, including Kevin Pollak, Stephen Baldwin, and Benicio del Toro, each of whom has his own special way of going wildly over the top when the time is right. The only weak link is the movie's apparent hero, who's played by Gabriel Byrne as a haunted, existential crook trying to go straight. Byrne goes for mystery here, but since he's surrounded by superb actors being as explosive and loony as they can be, he comes across as merely bland. The filmmakers have a sure feel for how much information to give the audience, for how much confusion we'll tolerate, and for just when to unveil new surprises. And when things threaten to bog down in talk, they'll stage a wild, beautifully chiseled shootout that begins in chaos and ends in heart-stopping symmetry. The Usual Suspects is a chilly film. You can't care about anyone in it. And finally, it really isn't about anything except its own intricate design. But designs don't have to be profound to be pleasurable. As you whoosh along the twists and curlicues of this movie's plotline, you have to admit, it's a pretty great ride.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia and from Rhino Records, presenting the new album Till the Night Is Gone, a collection of Doc Pomus classics by Sean Colvin, Bob Dylan, and others. This is NPR, National Public Radio.